morning, Glory, and evening, Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, May 14th, 2014. Great show ahead. But I ask, very rarely do I ask people to come in the studio for 3 hours. And, you know, I did it last week with Brian Lamb of C-SPAN. And I did it again with Stephen Pressfield, who's got out a brand new book called The Lion's Gate on the Front Lines of the Six-Day War. And, Stephen, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. It's great to have you in studio.
Hugh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, I don't do this. I think the last time you had a book out, we talked for an hour. And the first time you came in, we did a three-hour show in the Gates of Fire. And I wasn't really a big fan of the Alexander books. Then I read them, and I was. But here's what I wrote about. Yeah, I'm going to embarrass you at the start.
All right.
Over at HughHewitt.com, I don't have enough superlatives for this book. It is among the top five I have ever read. I think I know why. I was 11 when the Six-Day War began and ended, and I can barely recall even a mention of it. The 1973 war I know well because Richard Nixon played a central role, and I know Arendt's story well. I, of course, knew Israel won a lightning-like decisive victory in 67. I knew the outlines of the air campaign, the tank campaign, and the battle for Jerusalem. And, of course, I know why the ground is so sacred, so central to history. And I go on to talk about the fact that 3 years ago I went to Israel for 3 days. But I really had no idea. And Stephen Pressfield, did you, when you started the book, know what you were getting into?
No, I had no idea. I was as clueless as you are, Hugh. I mean, I had a general. I'm older than you, so I was 24, I think, during the Six-Day War. I was in the Marine Corps Reserve. I was a Lance Corporal Infantryman waiting to get sent to Vietnam, which I didn't get sent to. But when that happened, and as a Jew myself, I remember, I mean, it was electrifying. Moshe Dayan, the black eye patch, the victory, it just really, it blew my mind at the time. And I don't know, years and years passed. And as you know, I've written about the Spartans, the ancient Spartans. I've written about the Macedonians, the British, the Athenians, so on and so forth, even into the future mercenaries, when we talked last. But I thought, this was about 3 years ago, I said, but I've never written about my own people. And this is an incredible story. Forget about anything I might have written. Just the history of it. I think it ranks with Gettysburg or with Thermopylae, the Six-Day War, in pure military terms. But beyond that, it's a story of a return from exile. It's a story of 2,000 years of pogroms and persecutions, et cetera, et cetera, and the reclaiming with the capture of the Western Wall of the kind of central soul center of the Jewish people, and wrapping up, 2,500 years, coming full circle. So,
and the art, and there's a lot of art in this book, is that you tell the entire story of Israel in the course of telling a first-person collection of accounts of the Six-Day War, such that if anyone walks into the Lion's Gate and starts it, and they don't know anything about Israel, they will learn the history of Israel's reconstitution, its return from exile, in the course of reading about the moment-by-moment, minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour front line of the war. And that was genius. Did that take some figuring out how to do?
No, it sort of evolved as natural storytelling in the sense that you can't tell the story of the war in 67 without telling the backstory of the war in 56, the Sinai campaign, the War of Independence in 48, and then going back to the Romans, back to the Babylonians, back to the Holocaust, back to, the Dreyfus case, and all of the things that need to kind of fall into place for this to make sense, for the stakes of the story to make sense.
Now, there are two things I want to mention in the first segment. The first is a quote from page, very, very late in the book, page, there it is, page 372, from Bathsheba Hoffesher, sister of Shlomo Kenigbush. I lost both my brothers in the Six-Day War, and 36 years later, I lost both my sons. So there's a lot of suffering in this book, and you do not in any way paint that over, avoid it. You look it right in the eye, and you talk about it's a small country, and they took enormous losses to save it many times.
And I think that's really part of the story, because this story is not, I mean, it's painted sometimes in history books, with triumphalism in a sense, because it was such a great lightning victory. But the price was really high, and the price has always been high in Israel for just for survival. And that, to me, was a very important part of the story. I didn't want it to end on a note of triumphalism or anything like that, but on a sobering note of what this is all about over the centuries and the millennia.
It can bring tears to your eyes. The cheetah, and I can't say his last name.
Cheetah Cohen.
Yeah, and he lost his brother.
Nehemiah.
Now, you help me with the pronunciation. He lost his brother on the first day of the war, and they did not tell him.
Right. Cheetah Cohen is a really fascinating guy. I spent a lot of time with a helicopter pilot. And his younger brother, Nehemiah, was the most decorated soldier in the Israeli army at the time, tied with Ehud Barak, the former prime minister.
Yeah.
And defense minister.
Is he current defense minister? I think he is.
I guess he is. Yeah,
he's current defense minister.
Nehemiah, his younger brother, got killed on the first day of the war, but Cheetah was so important as a helicopter squadron commander that somebody made the decision not to tell him about his brother's death, and he didn't learn it until the last day of the war when everyone else was celebrating, and then his world sort of came crashing down.
And you read it so well because you told us about the silence decree in chapter 2 or 3.
Chapter one, and then
you follow Cheetah through the whole book because he goes everywhere. It's not a big country. There's four fronts in the war, and we'll go through this America. And you're welcome to call, by the way, at 1-800-520-1234. I asked Stephen to be here live because I thought people might want to react to the book, The Lion's Gate, and to the telling of the story. So, and to talk to Stephen Pressfield, who's I don't know how many millions of books he's sold, but he's among the most read authors in America and around the world. 1-800-520-1234. So whenever you run into Cheetah, you know his brother's dead, and they're not telling him. So Danny Matt is going and doing these extraordinary heroics with him. Does Danny Matt know his brother's dead?
I don't know. I can't imagine he did.
Yeah, but they probably just kept it at headquarters. Yeah. But you know, you're the audience, and you're watching, and you're knowing that at the end, no matter what he accomplishes, it will be a horrific. You know, he'll always be able to tell, I did this, I did that, and it's extraordinary. How is he as a human being to sit down with now?
Cheetah is just an amazing, colorful guy. I'll tell you just one little story about him, but there are many, many, many stories. He became, after the war, he was a captain on El Al for like 25 years. He was a member of the Knesset 3 times. And one of the things I didn't know about Israel, I didn't know anything really when I started, there's no constitution in Israel. They've never kind of stopped and got it together, partly because of the fact that they're sort of basically a state religion, and they've never kind of gotten around that. And so one of Cheetah's goals was to get a constitution written. But here's a story about Cheetah. Cheetah was famous for having a ponytail and also for riding motorcycles and for being he was a very extreme right party member. And he was very close, as you know from the book, with Arik Sharon.
Yes.
Ariel Sharon. And Sharon was prime minister when Cheetah was in the Knesset, was a Knesset member. So they happened to pass in the Knesset one day, and Sharon stopped Cheetah and said, you know, Cheetah, now that you're in the Knesset, you have to get rid of this ponytail. And so Cheetah said, Mr. Prime Minister, I will get rid of this ponytail when you bring the peace. And so Sharon started laughing and said, Cheetah, you're going to have that ponytail for a long time.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Sharon before his stroke?
No. Too bad.
And when he died, I had a number of Jews on, American Jews, to try and convey to the American people what he meant. And I still didn't get it. I didn't get it until I read Lion's Gate. Now I get it. It's pretty hard not to. Now you understand why Sharon was such a. Now I understand why Sharon was such a larger than life figure. When we come back, America, I'm going to continue my conversation. Your phone calls are welcome. I've got my eye on the news to see what the fires are doing in Southern California. I have linked the Lion's Gate at HughHewitt.com. Rarely do I go and buy my own books, right? Normally they send them to me. I went and bought 2 extra copies to have Stephen sign them, and you ought to go. Are they available at your website, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Are the books available from your website as well?
No, they're Amazon and Barnes & Noble and bookstores.
But we'll come back and talk for the entire hour. The Lion's Gate on the Front Lines of the Six-Day War came out last week. Stephen does not do a lot of media, doesn't have to. His books sell by themselves. But The Lion's Gate is one that if you have never read any of his other books, start with this one. Even if you think you know everything about Israel, start with this one. And if you know nothing about Israel, yes, you could go get Martin's Gilbert's History of Israel, which I read and interviewed him years ago. It's a great book. But I learned more in The Lion's Gate than I did in all of those other books combined. And we'll tell you why when we come back. Don't go anywhere. I'll keep my eye on the breaking news so that you can keep your ear tuned to The Hugh Hewitt Show with Stephen Pressfield. Stay where you are. Minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. My guest in studio with me today is Stephen Pressfield, one of America's greatest authors. His new book, The Lion's Gate, on the front lines of the Six-Day War, is an extraordinary book, and it's very different from anything you've read before. And it's different, actually, in its beginning, too, how it came to pass. And you've heard, if you've listened to my show for any number of years, David Mamet come on the program before. And a few months back, David was on talking about one of his stories in Three War Stories about getting weapons to the young Israeli state. And there's a guy mentioned in Stephen's new book, The Lion's Gate, Lou Leonard, who is also at the back of the book brought in connection with David Mamet. So, Stephen Pressfield, tell people the story about how Mamet fits into the Lion's Gate.
Well, I am, when I started this, I am so unconnected to things Israeli and really was coming from, you know, a baseline of zero. But I'm friends with David Mamet, so I called him up and took him to lunch and I asked him, you know, David, because I know David knows everybody, I said, do you know somebody in Israel that's connected to the military that can get me in and open doors for me? So he said, come to my house for Shabbat dinner this week, and I'll introduce you to somebody. And the guy he introduced me to was Lou Leonard, who was then like 91 or 92, former U.S. Marine captain, fighter pilot on Okinawa, flew F-4U Corsairs against the home islands of Japan. And in the 48 War of Independence, when Israel, you know, was declaring its independence, and they had no fighter pilots, no pilots of any kind, Lou volunteered and went over there, basically saved Tel Aviv, among other things. And so he kind of adopted me, Lou did. And he's in Israel now, just got married and moved over there at 93 or whatever he is. And so he said, you know, Steve, you're part of my family, and I'm going to do everything I can for you. I'll introduce you to everybody. And he kind of opened the doors for me initially that, you know, got this book started.
Now, give the overview of the process, why it's an oral history, but it's not. And it's a dramatic novel, but it's all true. It's just an interesting, different book.
Well, it's not a novel.
It's not.
When I first had the idea to do this, I thought, should I do this as a novel? And my editor, my partner, Sean Coyne, kind of sat me down and said, no, you can't do that. Because this has got to be narrative nonfiction, like The Perfect Storm or like Black Hawk Down.
That's it. That's what it is. Perfect.
And so,
well, you have to fill in a couple of blanks.
Right.
You have to fill in a couple. Okay, that's what narrative nonfiction. Got it.
Right. And I didn't even know narrative nonfiction was, you know. So Sean explained to me, well, this, it's like a novel in that it's a story. It's a narrative. But all the events actually happened and the real people actually did them. And you can't invent anything. So, and the reason why that needed to be done, I think, in this case, is because everybody's still alive. You know, the war only happened 45 years ago.
Except Moshe Dayan.
Except Moshe Dayan and a few others. Yeah. Arik Sharon is not still alive. But basically, everybody's alive, and they're still, so it's got to be true. Not to mention, that's the most powerful, you know, for instance, as we were talking to you off camera here, it was obvious to me that the liberation of the Western Wall was the emotional climax of the book.
Right.
So the question is, if you were going to novelize that or do it as a novel, you'd invent something, right? But I just knew the real story. If I can talk to the real paratroopers, and the title Lion's Gate, of course, comes from the gate in the walls of the old city of Jerusalem through which the paratroopers, the Israeli paratroopers, entered the old city and got to the Western Wall. So I knew that if I could just talk to the real guys who were really there, they were going to tell me stories that would be better than anybody could ever invent. I don't care, Shakespeare, you know?
There is a story, the flag story, which no one would dare invent for a novel.
Right, you couldn't invent it, yeah.
So tell people that you could not make that up.
This is a true story of a captain named Yoram Zamosh.
A company, right?
A company captain. Very good. You are a great reader. And I'm trying to think of how I could tell this without making it too long. But the way the paratroopers went to Jerusalem, it was like a 3-day, you know, it took 3 days, a night fight, another night fight, and then the next morning they got there. And the first night that they got to Jerusalem, shells were falling. The Jordanians were shelling the old city. It was a blackout. It was dark. When they'd come out on the street, the cars, every tire was flat from shrapnel, and every window had been blown out of every car from the shells. And the paratroopers met in an apartment of just a family, the Cohen family, of this one battalion, Battalion 71. And they were, as they were, tea was being served to them, and they were making their plans. What were they going to do? How were they going to attack? What was going to happen? And there was a grandmother in her 80s who had lived in the old city before the Jordanians took it over in 48. And she left the room at one point, and when she came back, Yoram Zamosh, this captain, is sitting down, and the grandmother, Mrs. Cohen, comes in right behind him and was standing over him and just said to him, "Take this." And he turned, and it was a flag of Israel. And she said, "This flag last flew in the old city when my husband and I," who had since passed on. And as Yoram Zamosh is telling me that story, he's sitting, and Mrs. Cohen was standing over him. He said, "To this day, I feel her tears on my back." So he tucked that flag away in his web gear and kept it for the next 2 days. And that was the famous photo of hanging the flag on the grill work over the Western Wall.
I'm not embarrassed to say it, because I just don't. I will admit my ignorance. I was unaware of the famous photo. I was unaware that this had happened.
Uh-huh.
And so when I saw the photo, because it's all new to me, and I'm saying, that's amazing. Moreover, and we have a minute and a half to the break, throughout... they weren't going to go in the old city. We're going to, in the next segment, we're going to tell why. But his buddies keep saying, "Where's the flag? Where's the flag?" And they keep checking, and he has to bring the flag out because they kind of know in the back of their head that this flag could be the most important. It could be the symbol of the reclaiming of Jerusalem by the Jews after 2,500 years, after 2,000 years.
And it was even kind of
I got a shudder thinking about it.
It was even kind of a screwed up flag. It was sort of only had color on one side of it. You know, it was like one of these things, I don't even know where they got it. You know, it was not like some great, you know, beautiful flag.
You've got beautiful photos in the Lion's Gate. How many of those are public archive and how many of those are appearing for the first time in print?
Probably about 50-50.
About 50-50.
And the story of getting those photos was like a saga unto itself. But they were very important to the book, I think, because when you read these stories, they're so kind of novelistic in a way, Cheetah Cohen's story with his brother, et cetera, that I think the reader is kind of partly saying, this is BS. You know, this can't be for real. It's too good, you know? And then, so it's very important. I think you come suddenly, you see a photo. You see a photo of Cheetah. You see a photo of Nehemiah, and you go, wow, this really happened.
And again, they're kids. Not Sharon, not some of the senior guys. He looks, you know, he's in his middle age, and the young Rommel Shmuel is 35. Okay, 37.
Yeah.
And so, but most of them are like 16 years. They might not be shaving for all I know. They're 18
they're
or 22.
They're 18, 19, 20 years old. Yeah.
And they're taking back the Jewish land for the Jews. And it's incredible. My guest in studio is Stephen Pressfield. The Lion's Gate is his brand new book on the front lines of the Six-Day War. We come back, we're going to do the primer of Jewish history, just so you get context for the 67 war, what that meant to get into the old city again and to liberate it for the benefit of the world, not just the Jews. That's why anyone can go there now. The Lion's Gate is linked at HughHewitt.com. It's in bookstores everywhere. My phone number is 1-800-520-1234. You're welcome to call. The fires are burning in California. We have our eye on it, but nothing more to report. Stay tuned. Four minutes after the hour, America, in studio with me this hour and for the rest of the day, Stephen Pressfield. I'll keep you up to date on breaking news. They fired the head of the New York Times today and replaced her, Jill Abramson, with Dean Baquet, who used to be the head of the Los Angeles Times. And that's kind of an odd story, but we won't know the backstory on that for a while. Fires are raging throughout Southern California. 30 homes lost in Carlsbad, which is a very wealthy community. That's very sad. Stephen Pressfield, who lives up on the west side of Los Angeles, has been threatened by fire. We always take it seriously out here because you never know when you're going to come home and there's going to be ashes next door, right?
Damn right.
You can say that. Don't worry. It's not 1964. The new book is The Lion's Gate. Stephen's narrative nonfiction account of the Six-Day War in Israel that is fascinating. Jack in Los Angeles, 1-800-520-1234. Jack, I'll let you have the first call before I go back to my agenda.
Great. I just wanted to, firstly, thanks so much for taking my call. I wanted to tell you about my mom who passed away a little over a year ago. She had gone back to, she was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has three generations ahead of her buried at the Mount of Olives. Having heard about the way that Jordanians desecrated the cemetery, she went back there to restore the graves, and she did so. She found her maps, went back, and got everything in order, and the rabbis who were now in charge had no records because the Jordanians had ransacked the office and thrown everything into the fire, and she had her maps from New York. And what she did was she gave them a copy. They fell to their knees and begged her for a copy so that they could restore the entire cemetery, all the portions of it that had been desecrated. Headstones have been strewn about, used in the flooring, in the urinals, in the unbelievable stuff.
Well, Jack, what you bring up, and I appreciate the call, and I want to make sure I get to this because I hadn't had it in my outline, but now you make me think about it. The Old City was not under the control of the Jews from 1948 forward, although lots of Jews had lived in the Old City under the British mandate. So I'm going to let you, Stephen Pressfield, take 3 minutes to kind of set up what happened to the Old City. How come they had to liberate it in 67?
Well, okay, I'll try to do this really, really quick here. 587 B.C., the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar besiege Jerusalem, capture it, and take Solomon's Temple, son of David, burn it to the ground, take the Jews into captivity into Babylon. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remember Zion. Cut to, this happened on the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, Tisha B'Av. 655 years later, to the day, same day, the Romans capture Jerusalem and burn the second temple to the ground. And so this is a great day of lamentation in the Jewish history. That Roman thing was what started the diaspora. At that point, the Jews were expelled from the Holy Land and lived as exiles and strangers in the lands of others for the next 1900 years. Finally, 1948, flash forward, the Jewish people finally have a state. They come home. But there's a war immediately. Five Arab armies, the day Israel declares its statehood, five Arab armies invade. The short version is there's a big fight for Jerusalem, for the old city of Jerusalem, and the Arabs win. The Jews keep I guess it's West Jerusalem. But the old city, the 1 square kilometer that contained the Jewish quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Armenian quarter, and the Christian quarter, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre,
the Mount of Olives,
everything,
yeah, everything
is in Jordanian hands, including the Western Wall. And there's the green line separates divided Jerusalem. And there are Israeli military posts on one side, Jordanian on the other. So that's how, in 67, the old city of Jerusalem is in the hands of the Jordanians under King Hussein, the Arab Legion.
And not just any fighters. Their very best Arab fighters, the Arab Legion.
The Arab Legion, British-trained crack troops.
And so the idea of going in, and at one point you write in the book, we were not trained for house-to-house combat. We were people of maneuver. We were tankers. We have never done anything like this. So
right.
The idea of punching through is Moshe Dayan, when we come back from break, we're going to talk about how he plays himself into the Ministry of Defense and how he agonizes over this decision. It's all told in great detail. Narrative nonfiction, that's what I've got to remember is how to describe this book. The Lion's Gate on the Front Lines of the Six-Day War, it is absolutely riveting. You won't be able to put it down. I read it on 2 airplane flights, and I've linked it at HughHewitt.com. You can go and get it there. It's at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There are e-books. ebooks. My Twitter people are telling me I got to remind you can get it from ebook. Might be. Did you do the audio version? Did you read it?
No, I didn't.
Someone else read it.
And
okay.
I'm not even sure how they did it because, as you know, Hugh, it's the voices of about 40, 50 people.
It must be very hard. Well, I'll have to listen to it.
Including women.
Don't go anywhere, America. The Lion's Gate is the book. Stephen Pressfield is the guest. 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Four minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Fires raging throughout Southern California. 30 homes have been lost in Carlsbad, but the winds are beginning to die down out here, and that's good news. We'll know the totals tomorrow. Fires also burning at the New York Times, where Jill Abramson has been ousted from the New York Times. This is the second time they fired their number one editor in less than 10 years. Drudge is reporting it's because she was demanding equal pay. Dylan Byers, who was a guest yesterday on the program, is writing up what they know about it, but they're shocked at the New York Times, because that's going to cause them, if that's true, if it's overpay, equal pay, they're going to be in the middle of a firestorm themselves, not the sort we have in Southern California. And China is kicking it up with Vietnam, and Vietnam arrested hundreds after anti-China riots today. And I was telling my guest Stephen Pressfield during the break that China surfaced a submarine in the South China Sea next to a Vietnamese oil platform, and ships are surging into the South China Sea from both Vietnam and China. And they fought a war before, and it's one of those things that nobody knows about, Stephen Pressfield, but by the time the show could be over, we might have a shooting convo and we won't know anything about it. And 67, the Israeli war of 67, the Six-Day War, occurs in the course of the Vietnam War. Do you think one of the reasons why Americans don't know much about it is because Vietnam consumed all attention at the time?
That's true, absolutely. In fact, that's why when Israel appealed to the United States for help prior in the days building up to the war, President Johnson was so distracted and was so, you know, worried about the outcome of that kind of thing, of the Vietnam War, that he, you know, really couldn't give them his full attention. And also, the war was over so fast, right? It kind of came and went, and then we were back, we in America, were back to the quagmire of Vietnam.
We were going to talk about the seventh day of the Six-Day War in a bit. And yes, I'm taking calls throughout the show, 1-800-520-1234. Marlon is sort of at work, and I know I see the lines ringing, so he's actually working out there today. That's good. Stephen Pressfield, before we went to break, we talked about 1948. Israel is founded. They divide Jerusalem, the old city, in the hands of the Jordanian. They put their best troops there. In 1956, people won't know this, but the American President Eisenhower becomes very upset when the British, the French, and the Israelis conspire to just destroy the Egyptian military and take the Suez Canal. And so there's at one point in the book, if you don't understand 56, you can't understand 67, the Mikvah Pass. Did I say that right?
Mitla Pass.
Give us the quick summary of the Mitla Pass in 1956 so that we can then move on to what they've got to do in 67.
Well, in 56, it was called the Sinai Campaign. It was 100, sort of a precursor to the Six-Day War. It was 100 hours in which the Israeli paratroopers took the Mitla Pass, which is deep in Sinai, just about 20 miles from the Suez Canal, and an incredibly complicated sort of scam war where the British and the French wanted to take back the Suez Canal that Nasser, the Egyptian president, had nationalized. And as a pretext, they kind of went in secret cahoots with the Israelis, that the Israelis would kind of take a provocative capturing this Mitla Pass, the threatened war, and then the British and the French would come in like schoolmasters disciplining naughty boys in the schoolyard. You know, these crazy Jews and crazy Arabs are at it again. We're going to have to go in. And they were going to, you know, take back the Suez Canal. And that was when Ike, they didn't tell us Yanks, you know?
And we were not happy.
Ike got a little PO'd about that and kind of wrapped their knuckles. And that, in many ways, was sort of the end of the British Empire, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, they withdrew Egypt
prestige.
Suez after that, yeah.
The next big thing was the Beatles, you know, and that was...
So 1950, but they won, and they showed that they could take on Egyptian forces.
Right.
But thereafter, Nasser was humiliated, and indeed, there's a lot in the Lion's Gate about the shame of the Arabs of 56, and how their refusal to accept Israeli military superiority led to the fact that this war crushed them, because they kept broadcasting propaganda for the world to believe that they were crushing the Jews, right?
Right. This was part of the mindset of a certain kind of bureaucratic chain of command in the Army. Sort of, I hate to say it, but it's we in Vietnam, we Americans in Vietnam, had the same sort of principle where the junior officers were demanded, had to come up with a body count, yeah. Right? They had to have numbers to put on paper. And nobody wanted to admit a reverse or a defeat. And the same thing happened with Nasser and the Egyptian army and the Syrian army and the Jordanian army, where they started propaganda, we won, we won, we won, and they were losing.
And because of that, the UN did not impose a ceasefire.
Right.
From the beginning, the Israelis knew, we've got to take it all before they shut us down, so we've got very limited time in which to
right.
operate.
The externally imposed ceasefire is a common phenomenon of any war in the Middle East, right? That's
right.
Why it doesn't go on for 8 years. It goes on for just a certain number of days because the powers are afraid this is going to be World War III, right?
Right.
We'll come in. So it's like the UN, the Russians, the Americans are always kind of hovering over saying, that's enough, boys. Stop right there.
You know, as you read about the Lionsgate, there aren't a lot of civilian casualties. The Jews are not bombing Cairo. They are not destroying the Jordanian capital. Have you seen the pictures out of Syria, Stephen Pressfield?
I have, of course, yeah.
It's an awful ghost town. There's nobody left in places of Damascus.
Yeah, it's a mind-blower.
Arab-on-Arab war.
You know? Yeah.
And so not Jews. The only calm oasis right now in the Middle East is, in fact, in Israel. And so I think it's fascinating in the course of this, and they go to great, great lengths. I want to talk a little bit about King Hussein. Because everyone in America now thinks young Hussein is a good guy, and he is. He's on our side. And King Hussein was a good guy, and he was on our side. But in 67, he does an unprecedented thing. He throws in with Nasser. And not many Americans remember Nasser. Do you think, we got a minute to the break, do you think Sisi, the new Egyptian guy, is Nasser-esque? Or is he Sadat-like?
Wow. You know, that's above my pay grade, Hugh. I really don't know. But I think, I mean, certainly what I know about Nasser was clearly pan-Arabism was his concept, and he was not an Islamist at all. He was the opposite.
Yeah, opposite.
He was a socialist that allied himself with the Soviet Union. He wanted a modern state with the most modern weapons and the most modern education. He really was a modernizer. He wanted a one unified Arab state from the Atlantic to, you know, all the way east as far as you could go.
Yeah, there's a big story today at Commentary Magazine about whether or not Sisi is the best we can do is taking over Egypt and eradicating the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'm reading it through the lens of having just read The Lionsgate and thinking to myself, well, if he becomes Sadat, great. But if he becomes Nasser, not so great. And that's why The Lionsgate matters right this very moment, America. Do not miss your chance to go and read it. 1-800-520-1234. If you have a question about Israel and the IDF for Stephen Pressfield, the book is linked at HughHewitt.com. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. 55 minutes after the hour, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thanks so much for listening. Stephen Pressfield in studio with me today. The Lionsgate is his brand new book on the front lines of the Six-Day War. First person's accounts of one of the most amazing 6 days in military history. A book that will rivet you, will cause you to just shudder at points and to be inspired at others. And there are two people at the heart of this book, Yael and Moshe Dayan. And I got to admit, I only knew Moshe Dayan from the eye patch. I didn't know anything about him. Didn't know how he played the government. And so this is a 3-minute segment. We'll talk about Yael when we come back, and we'll talk about the fighter pilots when we come back. But tell people about how Moshe Dayan, who he was, and how he played the government at the start of the war in 67.
Well, I'm not so sure that he played the government. I mean, he was the hero of the 56 Sinai campaign and kind of the paragon of the Israeli fighting commander. But he'd been out of the army for 10 years, and he was a member of the Knesset from an out-of-power party. But in the buildup to the Six-Day War, the government became paralyzed with indecision, and it was every day Nasser would move more tanks into Sinai, more airplanes, and the threat was building up, and they couldn't make a decision. And finally, the people just sort of, there was a demonstration of women outside the Labor Party headquarters shouting, you know, we want Dayan. And there was quite a bit of machinations going on that got him appointed Minister of Defense, kind of plucked out of nowhere.
He turned down an advisory role. That's why I say he kind of played the government. Right. He wanted no part of, I'm not going to be here window dressing.
Well, his famous quote was, "They have my phone number." And that was kind of his style. He was not going to lobby for anything. He made himself available and let his other kind of people push for him.
Next hour, we'll talk about what he did. Walt in Louisville, Kentucky, you're on with Stephen Pressfield. The book is The Lion's Gate. Go ahead, Walt.
Did you know that we had aircraft in the air headed toward the Middle East from the 82nd Airborne Division? We were on alert for 3 days, and I missed that on my West Point reunion because we were told we were going to go to war.
67 what? Got very close to going.
I did
big.
Not know that.
This was 73.
Oh, well, that's true. But see, that is absolutely true. When Golda Meir said they put up the temple weapons, right? They never launched the nuclear weapons at any time in the course of the Lions game.
No.
73, we were on the brink of that. So where were you stationed, Walt?
I was in the 82nd.
Do you know much? Then you're a paratrooper.
Yes, and I'm one of the unusual ones. I was in armor. We had a Sheridan battalion that was in the 82nd.
Did you know that as a result of, I think it's Wiseman, everyone in the Israeli army who's an officer has to have done a parachute drop?
Moshe Dayan. All of the officers in combat units, whether they were in paratroop units or not, had to get paratroop training.
I find that amazing. We're going to talk about why that is. Walt, thanks for the call. 1-800-520-1234. The Lion's Gate, one of the top five books I have ever read, and I'm very serious about that. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. Stay where you are. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning Glory and Evening Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. He's the author of, you'll know him as the author of Gates of Fire, perhaps the best-selling novel on war in modern times. He has a brand new book that came out this week, The Lion's Gate, on the front lines of the Six-Day War, that takes you inside of the Israeli war with the Arab world in 1967. For 6 days, this massive armored movements in the Sinai Desert, the battle for Jerusalem, the battle for the Golan Heights, and the most extraordinary battle of all occurs in the sky. And it is I live in Southern California, where Navy jets fly out of Lemoore and Marine Corps jets fly out of Miramar, and they often fly over our houses. And if you fly anywhere, if you drive anywhere, you hear them. Often there are stories about their sonic booms, and you wonder about them. And you know that when we started the Iraq War in 1991 and when we invaded Iraq in 2003, our fighter pilots completely destroyed every Iraqi air installation. But the greatest aerial combat that has occurred since World War II occurred in the opening hour and a half of the Six-Day War. Is that a fair statement, Stephen Pressfield?
I think so. The opening 3 hours or the opening 5 hours, yeah.
And now there is a chapter, it's your second part of the book, on
Operation Moked.
Which means
focus. Focus, yeah.
Tell people about this, because that's the part I couldn't put down. I was riveted, and especially the story of Lieutenant Gioro Rome and the death burst.
Well, Gioro Rome was the fighter pilot, the first Israeli ace who shot down, at 22 years old, shot down five MiGs. And
MiGs are good airplanes.
Oh, yeah, particularly MiG-21s, which were, you know, Mach 2 capable. And, of course, the Israelis had a great plane in the French-built Mirage as well. But I'm not sure what story were you particularly interested in here?
He sat when they all went off to execute him. We'll describe what the operation is. The head of each squadron has to leave behind four guys. He has to leave behind his four best pilots.
Right, his four best dogfight pilots. When the Israeli Air Force was only like 202 combat aircraft against 480. In Egypt, plus Syria, plus Jordan. And it was a preemptive strike, Operation Moked, a sneak attack, so to speak, where the planes were coming in at wave top level over the Mediterranean and at 100 feet, at 550 knots over the desert, and to strike between 12 and 15 Egyptian bases at exactly the same moment. And one of the most amazing parts of this story to me was the planning of Operation Moked by a gentleman named Rafi Sivron, who was just a captain at the time. And they kind of tossed a hot potato at him and said, here, plan this thing. And he figured out all of the incredible logistics of how the planes could do that. But I'll give you just one little kind of how it happened. The Israeli Air Force had no bombers because they couldn't afford bombers. So the bombing had to be done by fighter planes. And that meant, you know, you couldn't go in at high altitude and, you know, like, you know, over Germany or anything like that. They had to kind of dive bomb onto to destroy the runways. But to get to an altitude to dive bomb 6,000 feet, you'd be picked up by radar. So they had to come in on the deck at 100 feet, pick a, as you know from reading this, you pick a point on the ground, a waypoint like a gas station or a grove of trees that they knew. And when they hit that point, they would pull, climb to 6,000 feet, invert, roll onto their back, look up through the canopy, down at the ground, and then attack the airfield that they were attacking. So it was just an, and plus no GPS. This was all your wristwatch, headings.
And they had to memorize everything and radio silence.
In radio silence.
No one could say a word. In fact, I told someone the story 2 days ago of, I think it might have been Rome, watching another pilot preparing to take off with his flaps down. That's how I'll describe it as a layman. And they knew they were going to crash and die.
Airbrake. Yeah.
And they couldn't say anything. Everybody on the airfield saw this guy taking off and he was going to crash and die. And no one could say anything. And no one broke.
And no one did say anything. Yeah.
And he didn't. He realized it at the last minute.
The last minute he realized he had his airbrake.
But Rome had to stay behind. And so the quote that I grabbed from him is that he... His shoulder, I got here. My shoulders sag beneath the rescue harness. Here is the most momentous hour in the history of my country for which I have trained every waking moment of my life, and I am nailed to the dirt, contributing nothing. So they're sitting there because the 12 best pilots in Israel have to stay behind to defend Tel Aviv.
To defend the cities,
in the event anything gets through.
Right.
He gets his five MiGs anyway.
He got into the war immediately after that.
How did that happen?
Covered himself with glory.
Where did those Egyptians come from?
Say again, Hugh? What?
Where did the pilots that he shot down come from?
Well,
survived?
They sent him to the air bases in Egypt after that. And there were still a few planes in the air. And when he got there, the first wave had already done its damage. So there were like columns of black smoke rising from all over the Delta. And they didn't have to come in on the deck anymore. He could come in at 20,000 feet so he could see it all. And he went down to one particular, Beni Souef, I think, one particular airfield, Egyptian airfield. And there were a couple of MiGs in the air. And he just kind of got behind them. First time he'd ever seen a MiG, first time in real life, first time he'd ever been out of Israeli airspace. And just, you know, they were trained very well. They had learned the death burst, which was get behind a guy for 1 second with your gun sight right on the guy. And he shot down two right away and then shot down three.
Theory works. The death burst works. Don't fire anything off.
Yeah.
Marshall in California. Marshall, you're on the Hugh Hewitt Show with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate.
Hey, how you doing, Stephen and Hugh?
Great.
Hi, Marshall.
Hey, got a question for you. I'm looking at Abba Eban's book, My Country, and in one of his chapters, he talks about, and this is not taking anything away from the ground forces, but would you agree with his contention that the Six-Day War was effectively won in the first 6 hours because of the massive airstrikes of the Israeli Air Force?
Well, that's, I mean, you have to kind of say that the corner was turned there. Of course, at the same time, there were 1,000 Egyptian tanks in Sinai. So they could have crossed the border and done a hell of a lot of damage, even though air superiority had been achieved and the Israeli jets could really make mincemeat of those tanks. But I wouldn't say that the war was won to any of the paratroopers in Jerusalem or to any of the tankers in the Sinai Desert who had to fight it out. But yes, it was.
No, I would have to add, Golan Heights, if they had left it in the Syrian hands, would have been merciless on Israel for the last 47 years.
Yeah. But here's an interesting thing, Marshall, that one of the planner of Operation Moked, Rafi Sivron, said that some people had said that the war was over. It was a 3-hour war, meaning that the first 3 hours when the Israeli preemptive strike destroyed the Egyptian Air Force, that was everything. Other people said it was a 7-minute war because it was the first 7 minutes when they made their initial attack. And Rafi said, for me, it was a -1-minute war because he said, I knew if the planes could get to their initial points, that when they first went into their climb to attack and they were undetected, that nothing could save the Egyptian Air Force after that.
And that raises the question, Stephen Pressfield. People wonder about Iran going nuclear, and they worry that Israel can't pull it off, that they don't have the weaponry, they don't have the number of abilities to target. Anyone who reads the Lion's Gate realizes they've been planning for years for every contingency, and they're really smart.
Yes, that's true. Now, to take the other side of it, you also have to remember in the Yom Kippur War, 1973, that the tables were completely turned, and the Egyptians completely got the drop on the Israelis and managed to cross the Suez Canal and really threaten Israel's existence more so than even in the Six-Day War. So we got to give credit to everybody around here. These guys are thinking hard, every one of them.
And this, but the other amazing thing in the era of Edward Snowden, this plan of attack, Moked, was finished by 65, and no one breathed a word of it through 67.
Right, that is amazing.
It's just nowadays, and when we come back from break, the day of, when everyone's waiting for the war, but the war is not coming, and they have to send all their pilots home. They can't tell their pilots they're going to go off in the morning. They can't tell them. So they send everybody home. It's an amazing story. The Lion's Gate is full of them. 1-800-520-1234. Marshall, thank you. I'll be here with Stephen Pressfield, our eyes on the news, our prayers with the people in the middle of the fires in Southern California. And even we kind of feel bad for Jill Abramson, fired at the New York Times, our number one editor. That's a big story. We're following that as well. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Father's Day is coming up, right? And if your dad enjoys any kind of great writing, Stephen Pressfield's The Lion's Gate is perhaps the best book you could give them. And if you know a fighter pilot or any kind of a pilot or anyone who's ever served in support of a fighter pilot, this may be the best book on being an actual fighter pilot that I have ever read. And we're talking about Lieutenant Rome on page 17. What had motivated me to become a fighter pilot? To seek single combat in the sky, to test myself at what was, to my mind, the pinnacle of skill, resourcefulness, and daring. Stephen, you quote the three great rules of the Israeli Air Force. Number one, complete the mission. Number two, whatever you do, do it to your utmost. Number three, no alternative. And would you explain, that concept kept up again and again and again. And I thought to myself, only the Jews of Israel really get this. There is no alternative to winning.
That's exactly true. And Ein Brera is the phrase.
Say it again.
Ein Brera is the phrase in Hebrew. Right. And, of course, it comes from the geography of Israel that, at that point, the pre-67 borders, the waist of Israel was 9 miles wide. So a fighter plane coming across that border, an enemy fighter plane, could be at Tel Aviv in the central part of Israel in under a minute. And from the from Egypt, having to cross Sinai was 25 minutes to Israel. And so the strategy of a defense in depth, like, say, the Russians could use against the invading Nazis, where you just kind of fall back and fall back and fall back, you can't do in a little tiny country the size of New Jersey. So the other thing, of course, is that, you know, when America goes to war, we send our troops 13,000 miles around the world. And even if, no matter what happens to them, they come home and America is just the same as it was. Their hometown is fine. But in Israel, there are wars of survival where, you know, there is no alternative. And that phrase comes up again and again in the book because the commanders have to say that to their guys as they're kicking off, whether it's fighter pilots or tankers or paratroopers, that the survival of the country depends on you. There is no alternative to victory here. As Israel Tal, one of the tank brigade commanders or division commanders said, other nations can afford to lose the first battle and then recover, but we can't. Because if we lose the first battle, the enemy's in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and it's over. So that sort of is the underlying principle of the Israeli fighting doctrine.
It also produces incredible, and I'm going to get to a couple calls here, then we'll come back and talk about this. The first nighttime drop of paratroopers behind enemy lines in history occurs on the
right.
Second
insertion
day
by helicopter.
Insertion by helicopter. Yeah. Cheetah and the
Danny
other,
Matt.
And Danny Matt.
Who just died recently, unfortunately.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
And he describes this four-hour slog up the dunes.
Yeah.
It's only 2.5 miles. It takes 4.5 hours to get to their artillery. The Egyptian artillery is kicking the living daylights out of the Israeli tanks. And it's like you walked it. How much time did you spend with these guys?
Well, I spent a lot of time with Cheetah. I spent a few days with him. So, yeah, maybe the process of interviewing these gentlemen was really fascinating. I don't know how much you want us
to talk about that.
I mean, I had my kind of mentor and rabbi, a retired lieutenant colonel named Danny Grossman, an American who emigrated to Israel and raised his family there, et cetera, et cetera. He's an Israeli now. And he, like, knows everyone. And he kind of got me in, made the phone calls to these various people. And I talked to about 70 people, and some I spent 4 or 5 days with. Yossi Ben-Hanan, who is the guy on the cover of Life magazine.
Oh, yeah,
in the waters of the Suez Canal, is now a two-star general. I spent 5 days with him in Paris. He was the head of the Israeli defense mission in Europe. And so it got really very intense, and people wanted to tell their stories. You know, they really, and in me, they found somebody that was just, that understood and that was really interested. So,
I compare it to Stephen Ambrose. I got a full board here, so I talked to some of these people. Stephen Ambrose wrote Citizen Soldier, where he went back at the end of the Greatest Generation when they were still around, but a little bit older than your group. It's only been 47 years since this war.
Right.
Fought by teenagers. So they're all kicking around doing great. They're
right.
Just
they are
fine.
Doing great. Yeah.
You know, they're going to probably call you up tonight and say, why didn't you mention me?
Right.
You know, they're going
right.
to be mad at you. But they're all, how many of them are, you know, the American Greatest Generation did not want to tell their story. They were the silent company men. All these Jews in Israel, are they willing to say, oh, here comes this American screenwriter, author of Gates of Fire, he's not going to get it right? Or did they sit down and work with you to make sure you got it right?
It was a really interesting process, Hugh, because it sort of took, there was a little time to establish trust, you know, and I think that people had not heard of me over there, you know, so I was kind of just a guy coming in, a dumb American. But after 2 or 3 hours, when you know what it's like when you
I know what you've written,
when you ask the right questions like you're doing here,
yeah.
People realize that you care and you really want to know. And they did want to tell their stories, because I think they're, you know, people are 70 years old, 69 years old, 68 years old. You know, maybe it's time to get these stories really down right for the record. So I was lucky to be there. I really, the whole experience to me, I wish people could have it. I wish I had a camera over my shoulder the whole time, because it was such an education.
I can't wait till Prager and Medved read your, you know, these are my Jewish buddies who are also Salem Radio Network hosts. And they know and love Israel. They go every year. And I cannot wait to have them tell me what they think about this book. Because I'm just a goy, right? I've been there for 3 days and I know a little bit of military history, but it's so, enough about me. Let's go back to the phone. Denver Dick, you're on the show with Stephen Pressfield. We got lots of people waiting. Go ahead, Denver Dick.
I'll make it quick. I just ordered the book from Amazon, so you can take your cut from your guests.
All right.
As I recall, and maybe you can confirm this, when the Israelis Air Force hit the Egyptian Air Force basically on the ground, did they not, meaning the Egyptians, continue to tell the other, like the Jordanians, that everything was in control, they were wiping out the Israelis?
Yes, yes.
Keep them actually in the war longer than it...
Yeah. In fact, I'll tell you a really interesting thing that I never knew before, Dick. When the Egyptians were telling the Jordanians, and remember that Egypt is to the west of Jordan, right?
Yes.
They were telling them that they, the Egyptians, were attacking Israel. Their planes were attacking Israel. And the Jordanians on their radar could see these waves of planes coming from Egypt toward Israel. But what they didn't realize, but these were the Israeli planes
coming
home. So that's
you'll love this book. You'll absolutely love this book. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Houston, talk with Bill. Bill, you're on the Hugh Hewitt Show with Stephen Pressfield. Got less than a minute. Go.
Okay, this is fantastic conversation. Does Israel see God's hand in this whole thing? And
what a great question.
End of war, that when Jesus does come back and all nations attack you, do they see God's hand on their whole history?
Great question.
I think that actually in those days, Israel was much more secular than it is today, in the sense of today, at least you have the big ultra-Orthodox community. But you have to remember that Israel was founded as a socialist Zionist experiment, you know, or crusade, or whatever you want to call it.
That's why the Lionsgate finds the ultra-Orthodox commander of Company A, Battalion 71, and then the completely secular commander of Company B, who doesn't care if he goes into the old city first. I mean, you found all the right guys. The Lionsgate is linked at HughHewitt.com. Stay tuned, America. 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Four minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. In studio with me today, Stephen Pressfield, author most recently of The Lion's Gate. You probably know him as the best-selling author of Gates of Fire and dozens of other books, The Legend of Bagger Vance, and many other fine books, movie screenplays. But The Lion's Gate is unique in my experience. The narration of what happened in the Six-Day War in the first person, because he spent time with all of the men now and some women who are in their late 50s, early 60s, maybe very early 70s, who fought the war as young 18 to 25-year-olds. It's an amazing book. I checked during the break. Fires near the Mexican border in Escondido, Fallbrook, fetching Mrs. Hewitt's hometown, Ontario, Carlsbad, Lompoc, and even King City in Southern California's temperatures soar above 100 and the winds rage. More than 30 homes lost in Carlsbad. They won't know the true sort of nature. But if you want to see some pictures, LATimes.com has got some pictures. No loss of life. Back to the phones with Stephen Pressfield. Joseph Timothy Cook, himself a fighter pilot, joins me. Welcome, Joseph Timothy Cook. You're on with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate.
Hey, Hugh. Hey, Mr. Pressfield. Pleasure to have the opportunity. I called in because I wanted to. I've read a couple pages of your book that Hugh let me share. Or shared with me before he grabbed it back because he was having so much fun with it. And I wanted to call in because I had the unique privilege and pleasure of getting to know a handful of Israeli fighter pilots back in the spring and early summer of 67 when they were in the United States going through training at Cecil Field near Jacksonville in the A-4 Skyhawk, which was an attack plane. The United States had agreed to sell them some. Hadn't taken delivery on any of them, but they were getting their pilots trained up, and they all disappeared one day. the next day, the headlines were right there. It was just absolutely amazing. So I know a little bit about. I wasn't there, obviously, but I had a little connection with some of those guys, and 6 weeks later, after it was all over, they came back and resumed their training.
There is a story, and thank you, Tim, in the Lionsgate, that the car comes. Your car goes with you when you mobilize, and people start disappearing when they mobilize, but still secrecy. The Egyptians just expected to roll in, and Nasser was going to attack, right? You have no doubt in your mind that Nasser was going to attack.
Well, I'm not so sure, because I think what really happened was it got out of control for Nasser, I think. He sort of started rattling sabers, you know? And I think he hoped to have kind of a bloodless thing where he could regain the Sinai Peninsula and all that stuff, kick the UN out, which, but then what happened as he started, threatening Israel, the Arab street sort of erupted the emotion. The lid came off the emotion and it became kill the Jews, death to the Zionists, you know? And Nasser found himself in a situation where he had to keep the bluff going.
Damascus Radio, you report, their number one song was Cut Their Throats.
How about that? Yeah.
And they would listen to this every single day. They would go in and they were coming. Mike in Los Angeles, 1-800-520-1234. You're on with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate.
It's a pleasure. I was in the Six-Day War. I was a young soldier, and I want to tell you about Giora Rum.
There was a
celebration at the Diplomat Hotel in Jerusalem. The Air Force celebrated a victory party, and I was there with Danny Kaye. He had come to entertain the troops. And at that party, everybody was celebrating, and Moti Hod, who was the head of the Air Force, and Azer Weitzman, who was the head of one of the Israeli divisions, they were giving out ranks to all the pilots who had shot down planes during the war. Giora Rum came on stage, and he was sitting there, and he was waiting to get his rank. He was a junior lieutenant, which is, in Hebrew, it is a Segen Mishneh. And he was supposed to get lieutenant. And because Azer and Moti Hod had been drinking and celebrating, they were a bit tipsy. And instead of saying, congratulations, Segen Rum, Azer said, congratulations, Seren Rum. Seren is captain in Hebrew. And they had the rank to put on his shoulders, the two bars, for a full lieutenant. But nobody had the three bars for captain. So one of the other pilots who was sitting there said, hold on a minute, you said it, and you got to do it. So he took his rank off his shoulders, they put it on Giora Rum, and he went from junior lieutenant to captain within 2 minutes. And as a result, many years later, I know Giora, he's a wonderful guy, and he was the youngest general in the Israeli Defense Forces because he went in that night. He went from junior lieutenant to captain.
Oh, when we come back, we're going to talk. We're going to tell another Giora Rum story. But, Mike, tell me one thing. Have you read The Lion's Gate yet?
Not yet. I'm going out to get it right now.
All right, my friend. You will thank me. I'll be right back, America. 1-800-520-1234. Stephen Pressfield is my guest. We'll talk Rome stories when we come back to The Hugh Hewitt Show. Forty-four minutes after the hour, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. You know, it's kind of a slow news day when Aaron Burnett is reporting that they found the Santa Maria as the lead story on out front on CNN.
Already?
They've already found the Santa Maria. They found the Santa Maria before they found Malaysia Air 360, so they've switched over to the Santa Maria. But it's not a slow news day in Southern California where fires are raging, and I've got my eyes on them, and they're coming under control. 30 homes lost in Carlsbad. Traffic closures all over the place. It's a nightmare commute, but I have the perfect guest for you, Stephen Pressfield, who's the author of many wonderful books. But let me just tell you, The Lion's Gate, I just ran out of superlatives for it. That's how I began my post at HughHewitt.com, where you can order the book, and you should, and you will send me emails for months telling me, thank you, thank you, thank you. Let me go back to the phones. Jordan is a Marine. He's an active duty Marine. He's with the 3-1, and of course, Marlon is a veteran of the 2-1, so he told me this is really talking down in grade a little bit, Jordan, but I should put you on anyway.
Well, Mr. Hewitt, thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir. I wanted to be able to say something on the radio. About 2 years ago, Mr. Pressfield sent my entire company 250 copies of his book, The Warrior Ethos, and we all read it on the way to Afghanistan. The men loved it. And I just wanted to thank you over the radio, Mr. Pressfield, for being so generous with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Semper Fi. I hope it helped a little bit anyway.
Absolutely. It was great. Thank you, sir.
Where did you serve in Afghanistan?
I was in Helmand Province, and then we also did a MEU deployment to the Horn of Africa.
There was a terrific book by Rajiv Chandrasekaran on the work you guys did in Helmand, and I hope it holds. You guys secured the place. You brought peace to a region that didn't have peace, and hats off to you, Jordan. Great work. Thank you. And by the way, you will love The Lion's Gate because there's a lot of grunt work in here. And in fact, I want to go to that chapter before I forget. When the Jews take the decision to enter the Old City, and you have Moshe Dayan agonizes over this, right?
Yes.
Tell people why he agonized. No, most people would think, get it back, get it back. You've waited 2,500 years, get it back. Why does he agonize?
the, of course, the old, if you think about the old city of Jerusalem and you think about the holy places that are there, I mean, there is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is supposedly built on the hill of Golgotha. There's a slab, an iron, a stone slab where Jesus' body supposedly was laid there. The Via Dolorosa runs right outside where the stations of the cross, where Jesus carried the cross. The Garden of Gethsemane is there. The Dome of the Rock, the second or third holiest site in Islam, is there, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, not to mention all the sites that are holy to,
not to mention
the
Wailing Wall, right?
Right. But of course, what Diane was worried about was like the reaction of the Vatican. And, you know, he thought, what if Israeli mortar shells are go sailing through the roof of the Dormition Abbey, which is where the Last Supper took place? And, of course, he knew that this was going to be house-to-house fighting, dirty fighting with booby traps, machine gun fire. His troops would be taking machine gun fires from mosques, you know, just like our guys have now. And so he was desperately afraid that if the Israeli forces began, you know, damaging the holy sites, and there's nothing but holy sites in the old city of Jerusalem, that there would be some incredible backlash from the West. And also, prior to that, in the 56 Sinai campaign, Israel forces took the whole Sinai Peninsula, and then they were forced to give it back by the UN, by the Russians, and by the United States. And Diane thought, if we take the old city of Jerusalem and the powers force us to give it back, that will destroy the Israeli society emotionally. So he thought, I just can't let our troops take it that way. Now, what he wanted to do was kind of put a ring of steel around the old city, which he successfully did. The hills of the Mount of Olives and Mount Scopus and Augusta Victoria Ridge, and let the old city kind of fall by itself. But it didn't work out like that.
But events took their
course. The troopers took it.
And some of this house-to-house fighting, there are a couple of houses, a house of death. A couple of became very, very famous. And there's one line which I'm looking for where he says, a smart soldier, this is Zev Barkai,
yeah,
on page 2, a smart soldier, if he has not been ordered to go inside a house, won't go. He'll get ready. He will clean his rifle. He will take cover until an officer comes along and tells him to do it. And that's, they were huddled. The firefight, the combat in the old city is just amazingly intense, and lots of Egyptian and lots of Jordanians get killed, and lots of Israelis get killed.
Right. And that story, that Zev Barkai story, was he was alone. He was the operations officer of Battalion 71, and he came upon a few Israeli soldiers outside this one house that had been like killing people, and he said, follow me, charged into the house, and nobody followed him. And so he just fought it kind of out, you know, like a Western gunfight, and he kind of took over the house all by himself. And when he went outside, the guys were still outside saying, hey, Zev, how did it go? Everything okay? But he had a very wise attitude. He kind of understands how soldiers are. Another thing that he said is that, which is so true, is that soldiers, when they're under pressure, will go to sleep. Like they like, if it's nighttime and they're kind of cuddled up and they're cold, they're supposed to, because they want to wake up and find that everything is okay.
And someone else has won the war.
Someone else has, so they've, as an officer, you've got to keep people alert.
First, Jeff in New York, listening on AM 970, The Answer. Go ahead, Jeff.
I got to tell you, the best thing I ever hear, and I listen to it every year on Yom Yerushalayim, is there's a tape of the army entering the Temple Mount and a rabbi blowing the shofar and everyone crying. I mean, that's how important that moment was for us. The interesting thing is, and I'm sure, I can't wait to read your book because I'm sure you cover it, is that while Moshe Dayan was one of the heroes of the Six-Day War, he was the villain of the Temple Mount. And one of the reasons why they're still fighting over it is because the first thing he did was, without asking anybody, he tossed the keys over to back to the Islamic wave.
Actually, in fact, the controversy about raising the Jewish flag on the Temple Mount is very detailed in the Six-Day, in the Lion's Gate. And Diane was going to do this on his terms, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Pressfield, this was how he was going to roll.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Jeff, you're going to love this. I can't wait to read your review of it.
I can't wait to read it, and I'm going to the site and buying it tonight.
All right, you're gonna when you post a review of it, let me know. I'll be right back, America. 1-800-520-1234. The Lionsgate is in fact linked at HughHewitt.com. Stay tuned. 55 minutes after the hour, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. One more hour ahead with Stephen Pressfield. We'll keep you up to date on the fires in California. The news of the firing of the New York Times editor, of course. Stephen Pressfield in studio with me. Drove over to join me in person. The wildly successful best-selling author of Gates of Fire, many other books, The Legend of Badger, Bagger Vance, etc. But his brand new book, The Lion's Gate, on the front lines of the Six-Day War, is one of the very best books I have ever read. And I would encourage, like Black Hawk Down, and if you don't know anything about the 67 war, you're going to read it many times. It may be the most heavily annotated book I've ever brought to the studio, and it's got its spine broke already. I spent so much time with it in the last week. But you do not let us ever forget, Stephen Pressfield, the cost of this. And you talk about Yossi Ben-Hanan, who's a 7th Brigade ops officer, as they're driving through the Sinai. He's a recon battalion guy. His Jeep driver is killed, and his first thought is, what will I tell Joshua's mother? And there are these incredible accounts of tanks and half tracks on fire. And for people to go into a tank and get somebody out, you describe it's madness to try and rescue someone out of a tank.
I mean, I had never thought about this myself, Hugh, because I don't know anything about tanks myself. But there's ordnance inside. There are shells, you know, inside the turret. There are, you know, 30, 40 shells, high explosive shells, white phosphorus shells. If the tank is on fire on the inside, and in order to get somebody out, to help somebody out, you've got to think about it. You got to go in face first, hands first. And a lot of these, the tankers had, you know, Nomex gloves or fireproof suits on. But, of course, those burned up in a second, you know. And but the anybody that was going to rescue somebody has to go in bare hands, and you know what guts it takes to do that.
I mean, and Ori Orr is one of these guys who keeps coming back. He's a first person account at many places. Tell people who he is.
Ori Orr was the commander of the reconnaissance company of an armored brigade in Sinai. And what that meant was they had American Jeeps, CJ-5 Jeeps, and they had to lead the tanks into action because in those days, right, no laser guiding, no any of that sort of stuff, no navigation aids for the tanks. A tank on its own would just, the first ditch it would come to, it would crash into the ditch, you know. So these guys were out front of the troops. And what happened was when they would run into resistance, a lot of times they couldn't wait to have the tanks come up because that would waste half hour, 45 minutes. So these guys in their unarmored Jeeps and, you know, half tracks would, you know, have to lead the assault. And, of course, this one particular outfit was the first to reach the Suez Canal, but they had the most men lost and the most decorations of valor for any unit of their size.
That's an incredible story. Let me get one quick one. And Victor in Highlands, you have 30 seconds. Victor with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate.
5-2-8.
Uh-oh, Victor. That's what happens when you put the phone down. You're going to miss your shot at stardom, Victor.
I'm here.
You got 20 seconds.
I'm here. I want to ask about the slogan that was popular in Egypt. Today is Saturday, tomorrow is Sunday. Did you get that in the book?
We'll ask him after the break. Don't go anywhere, and I'll bring it up to him. But stay closer to the phone next time. I'll be right back with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate and the headlines, breaking news all the time here on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning glory and evening grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. So I am very lucky to have in studio with me today, Stephen Pressfield, who is one of the country's greatest authors, the author of Gates of Fire, which has sold millions and millions and millions of copies. The Lion's Gate is his brand new book, and I think it's going to go as long and as well and as deep into the public consciousness as Gates of Fire. It is a narrative nonfiction account of the Six-Day War written from Stephen's adventures in Israel with the survivors, the people who were the veterans of the Six-Day War, fought in 1967 over 6 days. Israel, surrounded by the Arab countries, facing annihilation from Nasser, from Jordan's King Hussein, from Syria, from Assad, from the Iraqi army. The Iraqis got into this, right? They sent troops.
They threatened to get in, but they never actually crossed the border or fired a shot.
Okay, and the Syrians, did they start shelling?
Yes, yeah, so they were shelling, you know, the kibbutzim along the border, all the way through.
And the Jordanians got in.
The big, big fight on the Golan Heights. I mean, lots of
We're going to cover that this hour because that was the seventh day of the six-day war, as you call it in your book. But I got to start this hour because I want to make sure we do not miss this story. Chapter 47, Fugas. And this is unbelievable. I told my friends about this morning. I said, no one would believe this. It's made up. No one could possibly think this happened. So you tell the story of this squadron.
Well, this was the training squadron from the flight school. Flew an old clunky plane, a French plane called a Fuga Magister. And the situation was so desperate that the Israeli Air Force had to sort of cobble together a squadron of 24 of these planes, bringing in El Al captains to fly some of them. And the gentleman who tells this story, Tzvi Kantor Kanor, was the youngest pilot. He was not operational yet. He had not yet joined his squadron, and they put him in these trainers. There was no gun sight on it. It was just an X on the front of the windshield. There was no weapons panel. They had to put the weapons panel together. They fired rockets. That was all they had, and they would come in. Their job was to defend against Jordanian tanks that were coming up from the Jordan Valley towards Jerusalem. And so they would go in against the columns that were climbing the hill out of the Jordan Valley, and they would attack a tank with a salvo of four rockets, and they would hit it from 200 meters. And according to Kantor, who's telling the story, if you tell pilots that today, they will say you're either crazy or you're lying, that there's no way that anybody gets that close to a tank to release their ordnance. But that was what they did. And these guys, these kids and these El Al pilots basically saved Jerusalem from the east, from attack from the east.
And the pictures, people remember the highway of death from the 1991 Iraq war when Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard got trapped trying to retreat. And as you detail in the book, you blow up the front of a tank column, you blow up the back of a tank column, everyone is trapped and you destroy them all. If you blow up the front of a runway and the back of a runway, no one can take off. So this is kind of basic stuff. But these kids, these 18-year-olds, and then these old guys who are my age, 58, and they're back in the pit, and they're flying these non-combat planes. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. No one would believe it. And are they honored, or do they have reunions and stuff?
Oh, that's a really good question. The weird thing about this one squadron, of course, was that it was just put together for this one-time action, and it was disbanded after that. The pilots went back to El Al. The young pilots joined their regular squadrons and continued so that the squadrons sort of ceased to exist, and there's no records kept, no reunions, none of that kind of thing. So it's kind of a little bit of a phantom squadron that did great, great service and then was forgotten.
Now I want to go back.
Footnote to the war.
To the title of the book, The Lion's Gate. And I'll get back to your phone calls at 1-800-520-1234. Steve and Charlotte, Tom, Denver, the rest of you, don't go anywhere. I'm going to get back to your phone calls. But The Lion's Gate. I've been to Jerusalem. I spent one day there. And so I know that there are different gates into the city. But I didn't realize, and I want to go back to Yoram Zamosh.
Zamosh. Yoram Zamosh.
Only twice in 3,000 years has Jerusalem been conquered from a different direction. Once by King David and once by us. This is a paratrooper in Battalion 71. Jerusalem's been conquered a lot, but it's always been from the north. People have always come down from the north and
out of the north and evil comes.
You have lots of Old Testament in here. The Proverbs are interesting. Would you describe, leading up to the retaking of the old city by the Jews, how they came to enter the Lion's Gate, and then the geography of the Lion's Gate? Because I had no idea the physical terrain that they had to go through.
Well, here's one interesting trivia moment here, is that the code name for the Lion's Gate was Vietnam. In other words, in every site in Jerusalem and every side of the war had a code name, so that over the radio, when the Israeli forces were saying, proceed to point X, the enemy didn't know what that was. And so, technically speaking, when the order was given to enter the old city and they were to enter by the Lion's Gate, the proper way to articulate that over the radio was enter Vietnam. But the brigade commander, Mota Gur, recognize the historical moment. This was the culmination of 2,000 years where the Jews had not possessed the old city of Jerusalem. And so he knew this was a historical moment. So he came out in the clear and said, you know, enter the lion's gate.
Entered in the clear, meaning over the radio, over so the that radio, the world could hear it and it could be recorded.
Right.
But it also tells the enemy, and they're coming to the lion's gate.
Right. And then getting back to Yoram Zamosh for a minute, there he was in his battalion, he was like the religious guy. Everybody else would say he was the religious guy. And so he had asked his battalion commander, Uzi Ilam, if we get the order to enter the lion's gate, can my company go first? And they had said yes. So he's down there sort of waiting. It's a... The old city is surrounded by giant walls. It looks, if you've never been there, you know, 40 feet high. Looks like they come out of the Bible. Actually, they came from Suleiman the Magnificent about, you know, 1500 or so. But the Lion's Gate, it has a long alley, and then there's a gate that you have to enter. And to enter in this long alley was very dangerous because there were Jordanian soldiers at the top of the walls. It was like a kill zone. So Zamosh, Yoram Zamosh, was kind of hesitating at the mouth of the alley, about 200 feet from the gate. And suddenly, Mota Gur, the brigade commander, came barreling past him in a half track, wanting to be the first guy in to make history, which was completely crazy because he was the brigade commander, risking his life. But he zoomed through the gate and then
put a round into a steel gate.
Yeah,
right?
They put a tank, opened the gate with a few rounds in it. But so Mota Gur became the first person to enter the Lion's Gate, and history will record that.
Then there's a famous photograph, it's famous, but not to me. Not to an American non-Jew, that a half dozen of them get up on the Western Wall, which is, they couldn't even see. You communicated this very well, that a religious Jew prior to 1967 couldn't even see the Western Wall.
Right. Of course, you couldn't enter the old city because the Jordanians, you know, controlled it. But you could go to two places, Mount Zion, which is not really a mountain, it's just a rise just outside the walls. And Yoram Zamosh tells a story. You climb to kind of an observation post, and standing on tiptoe, you could just see a poplar grove above the Western Wall. And you were instructed not to point with your finger because the Jordanians might take yet for a rifle and sniper fire might be coming your way. And so from outside the old city, you could not see the Western Wall at all. So when these guys entered the old city and went up on the Temple Mount, I'm talking about the Israeli paratroopers, after they entered the Lion's Gate, particularly Yoram Zamosh and his people, who were the first guys to get there, they were looking for the poplar grove. And once they found the poplar grove, they still didn't know where the Western Wall was from there. Shall I tell that story?
Yeah, when we
here?
Come back from break, because okay. it's amazing what GPS, the world has changed so much in 45, 47 years since the Six-Day War. But you will get chills when you read this story of Jews reentering the old city. Many of my audience have been to Israel. Many will go again or go for the first time in the future, and they will read the Lion's Gate before they go. I guarantee you of that. Stephen Pressfield is my guest. The Lion Gates is linked at HughHewitt.com. I'll be right back. 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Twenty-one minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Breaking news as it happens. The fires in Southern California appear to be coming under control. Donald Sterling, they're replaying the Sterling interview. Who hasn't seen this already? I don't understand it. Nothing must be going on except that John Boehner says there are new questions about the Obama administration's handling of the Benghazi attack, and those are going to be handled by the committee. And we have Mike Pompeo of the committee on tomorrow, and we'll talk to him about it. In studio with me is Stephen Pressfield. He's the author of the brand new book, The Lion's Gate, on the front lines of the Six-Day War. It is really an amazing, compelling story. Lines are full. Before I go back to the phone, Stephen, though, we left the trooper headed towards the Wailing Wall, and he couldn't find it. They could not find the Western Wall.
Yeah, they didn't know where it was. So this is another true sort of crazy thing. Suddenly, they were in a firefight, you know, on the Temple Mount alongside the Dome of the Rock. And then this ancient Arab kind of appeared out of nowhere with a long robe and a key around his neck. It's like if you wrote this in a Hollywood movie. And so they went over to him and said, you know, where's the Wailing Wall? How do we get to the Wailing Wall? They were looking for a particular gate. And it turns out that he was the gatekeeper to this gate. But he was too terrified to help them. So they dragged him kind of over to the gate. And they were talking to him first in Arabic, then in English. And finally, he answered at the gate. He said, I knew you were coming. I've been waiting 19 years for you to come, which was from the time that the Jordanians took over. So he gave him the key. They went through the gate, and there was the wall.
Oh, it's an extraordinary story. It will give you chills when you read it. And because my friend Kurt Schlichter just tweeted he's listening, and he's a tanker, and because my friend Fritz Mertens is a tanker, I just have to talk a little bit about Arik Sharon and the young Rommel. Now, different people. Sharon is the commander of the whole offensive. And the photos of him, people of my age think of him as this big guy. He's very kind of intense looking. And you've got a couple of photos from 56 and then one from 67. But Shmuel and his brother,
Gordish,
is the young Rommel. And why do they call him that? And why would they let a brother be the number two to a brother? That just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, this Shmuel Gordish was the colonel in charge of the 7th Armored Brigade, which was sort of like the hotshot regular army, great armed brigade. And he was a very mercurial character, and people used to get in fights with him, and he'd fire him. And finally, he had to put his own brother in as his operations officer because nobody else could work with him. And they got in a fight, too, and his brother quit, Yoel Gordish quit, and Shmuel said, well, let's go to mediation over this. And Yoel said, well, who will be the mediator? He said, how about our mother? And so he kind of
Got him back
into the thing.
Now, and also before I go to the calls, Golan Heights, the 7th day of the 6-day war, the Israelis know the UN is going to impose a settlement, and they get a call. We can't let this go, but they got to get troops up there. And this cheetah who begins the book and ends the book, how do they win that war? It's wild. It's completely improvisational military
right
stuff.
It was kind of insanity up there on the last day, in which there were two helicopter squadrons up there that could ferry paratroopers in, and the paratroopers were all there, but they couldn't get any orders from anybody. So we're just kind of these three guys, Danny Matt, Cheetah Cohen, and Rafi Sivron, on the ground, kind of making up the rules as they went along. And they would fly paratroopers into certain crossroads and kind of claim them for Israel. And so they'd put troops on the ground. And meanwhile, the Syrians were kind of fleeing back towards Damascus. So it became a, eat and bite what is on your plate. How much can you get before the UN shuts you down?
And one memorable story. I can't remember the name. A fellow is wounded, and his commander hears about it and orders Cheetah to go get him. So tell that story.
Okay, this is actually wasn't Cheetah, but it was a guy named Rafi Sivron, who was the planner of Moked, but who also was a helicopter co-pilot and navigator. And this was the last day of the war, and the helicopter pilots had been flying for 6 days, and they were like it was the middle of the night. They were dead asleep. Nobody could wake them up. And one of the generals, Dado Elazar, said, I've got one of my colonels up there on the Golan Heights. He's been wounded. I want you to evacuate him. So anyway, the short version
But he also says, and he won't go.
And he won't go. So here's a pistol. I want you to bring him back by force. So the short version is Rafi flies up, finds the general, and says, I'm going to take you back by force. And the general is kind of a colorful character. He says, listen, Rafi, sit down, have a cup of coffee, think about this. He says, I'm really not wounded that badly. Stick with me today. We're just going to go around the northern part of the Golan Heights, and we're going to take every bit of real estate that we can. And I promise you, at the end of the day, I'll go into the hospital with you. So that was what they did. And at the very end, a UN team arrived with a Syrian colonel, and the Syrian said, okay. He said, stop. You've got what you've got, but stop here. And so that was kind of how the final border was drawn.
And then he flew to the hospital. So he complied with the order.
Here's one final tidbit that's not in the book. Like 10 years later, Rafi Sivron, the helicopter pilot, ran into this general, since retired, at some event. And the general said, Rafi, thank you so much. You made my life. What I did on that day was the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. Thank you so much for not taking me into the hospital.
How much did you hear about that? from these guys? Because they were also scared to death, and you communicate quite clearly the paratrooper, the thing he wants to do the most is do a combat jump, and the thing he's afraid of the most is to do a combat jump. And so this is the most significant day of their lives, and they're telling you about it 47 years later. How many of them recognize that?
Oh, they all recognize it. It was very emotional and very touching. And every year, all of these units get together, and they really take care of anybody that has died, the families of anybody, and even people like who die of, you know, cancer or something, you know, since the war, are treated as kind of casualties of that. And they really, the bond is amazing. They're very aware of what they did, because this is 2,000 years of history. They just happened to be the ones that history chose to be there, right? It could have been anybody else, but they were the ones, and they, and it's not as though they see it in an egomaniacal way. They recognize the import for the Jewish
people.
The
obvious question is that 6 years later, as you said earlier in the show, the Egyptians get the jump on them.
Right.
You could write another book.
Absolutely.
About that war. It won't be as significant because they don't retake the old city of Jerusalem. They don't reclaim the holy places of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam for international control and the control of the Israelis. But you could do that. Is that cross your mind?
It crossed my mind, but you hit the nail right on the head, Hugh. That what make to me, speaking as a novelist and as a writer, you always look for what's the metaphor in the story, you know? What's the deeper meaning? Why is this only a Jewish story? Is it only an Israeli story? And I don't think it is at all. I think it's a universal story. Just like the Spartans at Thermopylae are a universal story, or Gettysburg is a universal story. But what's universal here, as we're talking about it, is that the recapture, the liberation of the Western Wall after 2,000 years, where that symbolized the Jewish people's return from exile. Finally, this, their holiest place, as Moshe Dayan said, we have returned to our holiest places, never to part from them again. So that's to me what made this not just a military story. It made it a story that's universal.
Oh, and so deeply compelling, even for non-Jews, especially perhaps for non-Jews. 1-800-520-1234. Your phone calls are next. The book is The Lion's Gate. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. The fires are under control, mostly. I'll post you up on that after the break. Stay tuned. Thirty-four minutes after the Our American Chew Hewitt with Stephen Pressfield on a day of fire in California and upheaval at the New York Times. I have in studio with me Stephen Pressfield. He's the author of The Lion's Gate, On the Front Lines of the Six-Day War. Extraordinary book. It's going to be just hugely selling for years and years and years, because like Black Hawk Down, like every great story of war, it will engage you in the lives of these young people at moments of life and death. Combat decisions which are made on the spur of the moment. And the fighter pilots are all going to read this book and pass it around, because it just loves the fighter pilots. It quotes one of them as saying, it's great feeling to be the cavalry. Agassi and I are over the same area by the canal when ground troops call for help over radio. Egyptian planes are attacking them. It's a great feeling to be the cavalry and able to rush to the aid of our warriors under fire. I catch an Aleutian 28, a light bomber above Baradel Lagoon, and I don't even drop the tanks. I do a hindquarter attack. He has a 23-millimeter gun aft, so I don't come at him from directly behind. I get him from 600 meters. He blows up right in front of our troop. He got four MiGs. I mean, these guys, this was the last great air battle, right?
Yeah, really. It's sort of like the Battle of Britain, in a sense of where you really had dogfights that were, not missile dogfights, but cannons, you know, where you have to, the fighter pilots has to get, you know, right behind another plane to shoot it down.
And that, you tell the story very well. Let's go to the phone. Steve in Charlotte. Hello, Steve. You're on with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate.
Hi, you. Just picked up the book. Looking forward to reading it. Semper Fi, Mr. Pressfield. It's an honor.
All right, Steve.
Two books I read of yours I couldn't put down were Killing Rommel and Gates of Fire. And my question kind of segues from what you said a few moments ago, is regarding what you think makes these stand out as classics. Is it that you have a burning desire for encyclopedic knowledge in these areas, and writing the book is just the aftermath and a lot of fun to put them all together?
Great question.
Could you rephrase that question? I'm not exactly sure what you mean by it.
I'm wondering if you yourself, if you would write this book, even if no one read it, because you just
yes,
you
I would
want to have that knowledge.
Yeah, but I think that anybody that writes a book or, let's say, directs a movie, you have to kind of, because it's going to be a 2-year, 3-year project, you have to fall in love with it on its own merits. You know, you can't do it because I think I'm going to make money on this or I think this is going to be a hit. At least this is for me. I get kind of consumed with these things, just geeked out over them, you know, and I just want to find out everything I possibly can.
No more. And these guys took you, who took the Lionsgate, thank you, Steve. They took you on the path they followed. So you actually physically walked the
right
road they walked.
Right. And going up onto the Temple Mount, Yoram Zamosh and Uzi Ilam and Moshe Milo, they walked me right through it, which
that's
was
amazing.
Absolutely fascinating.
Lily in Tucson, you're on with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Lion's Gate. Go ahead, Lily.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Stephen and Hugh. Your conversation has been riveting, so the book has got to be. But as I'm listening to you speak, I'm thinking back, oh, I didn't pay much attention in history as a youngster. You know, I just sort of glazed over. And when I started studying the Bible, I started as well reading some novels that were historical novels by Brock and Bodie Taney. I was wondering if you were familiar with them because they have chronicled the history of the Jews before, during, after the Holocaust, and then, of course, at 48 and 67.
No, I'm not, Lily. I'm not.
Fascinating series, but, you know, what you're bringing up is the real-life events that they have wrapped up in a novel, and you keep saying, you know, it could have been written in a novel or it could have been a movie.
But in a movie and a novel, when they say based on actual events, you always want, like The Monuments Men just came out, and that took a lot of liberties, and it was a fine film. I enjoyed it. But you want to know what's real, and everything here is real. And thank you, Lily. You borrowed from both Dianes, and we haven't mentioned Yael Diane yet. She went up to Ugda Sharon, which is they named their task force over their generals, right?
Yeah, this is an Ugda is like a division-sized force. It's kind of unique to the Israeli army, but it's a one-time force that's put together for a specific operation or to fight a specific enemy, and it's named after its general. So like the division that Arik Sharon was in charge of was called Ugda Sharon, and then Israel Tal had Ugda Tal, and Avram Yofi had Ugda Yofi. And that's
Do they argue over how they did relative to each other? I mean, veterans, and so what do they say? Like 3-1-2-1. Marlon was talking about the Marine Corps divisions earlier.
Yeah, of course. You know, that's the way soldiers are in the army. Yeah,
but Yael is Diane's daughter. She's in Greece, and she says at the very beginning of your book, Israelis go home when war threatens.
Yeah. Now, Yael Diane wrote you asked me before, Hugh, what I thought was the best book about the Six-Day War, and I named her book along with Michael Oren's book. She wrote a book called Israel Journal, 1967, that I relied on very heavily for this one, and she was with Ugda Sharon as a war correspondent. Actually, she was a Segan Mishnah, second lieutenant in the reserves, and she had a novelist's eye and just put incredible details and stuff in there.
Great More stuff. Coming up after the break. Stay with me. The book, The Lion's Gate, is linked at HughHewitt.com. Forty-four minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. No additional details yet out of Carlsbad in Southern California, south of my studios, where the fires are raging. My friends down there are texting me that there's lots of smoke, but no casualties. That's good. California's got the best firefighters in the world, really, and so I'm sure they're working around the clock to make sure that those do not spread. No additional details on the firing of the New York Times editor. We'll cover that tomorrow. Mike Pompeo joining me tomorrow, a new member of the Select Committee on Benghazi, who will be investigating Benghazi. Stephen Pressfield has been my guest in this segment and one more. His new book, The Lion Gate, is extraordinary. It's among, I think, the top 5 books I have read. And I don't say that lightly. I put it up there with The Looming Tower. Someone sent me an email last night after I posted about it. Is it as good as The Looming Tower? They're different books, but it's been 10 years since I've been this complimentary of a book. Stephen Pressfield, you talk about two guys in here, Ben Gurion and Charles Wingate, who are not really there, but they matter a great deal. So just a word or two about both of them and why you pause in the middle of a book about 1967 to talk about a Jew and an Englishman who aren't part of the 67 story.
Well, particularly Ord Wingate, it was an English officer that came to Israel in the 30s, I think. I'm forgetting exactly when that was, but he was a guy who founded many of the doctrines that the Israeli army fights by. Night fighting is a big part of the Israeli doctrine, of unconventional tactics, of trying to strike the enemy where they least expect it from a different thing. And he used to fight. He fought with Moshe Dayan as a young man against the Arab gangs that used to sabotage the Iraq pipeline. And one of the things he used to do, he would mount the taillights of his jeeps on the front of the jeeps so that the enemy could tell which direction he was going. Another thing is when they would make a raid against a certain Arab position, he would insist that his guys buy their sandals at the local Arab markets so that the footprints they left in the sand could not be distinguished from the local shepherds.
There's a word I'm looking for from the Old Testament, a trick that Sharon says, complexity at the top, simplicity at the bottom. But there's this one word, I wrote it down, that you say, taguba? What is that?
Oh, takbula.
Explain what that is.
That's just a word for a stratagem or a ruse. And I'm not sure what the verse is in the Bible, but it says, by a takbula shalt thou wage war. And this was Arik Sharon, who was like a great strategist and battle planner. He would always try to have takbula following takbula following takbula. A trick, a misdirection, a ruse, something, always a twist in a plan so that the enemy, what he was trying to do was make the enemy respond under conditions of chaos to some emergency that they had not prepared for, being struck from an angle they didn't think they were going to be struck from by a different composition of forces or by sealing off the area in a different way. So takbula.
It sounds like getting inside their OODA loop, the observe, orient, decide, act, and then you want to get inside your enemy's OODA loop.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
But Ben-Gurion, of course, the founder of modern Israel, and he's on the sidelines for this thing.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a sad story in the sense that at this point he was getting a little old, and he really didn't believe. I mean, Moshe Dayan had been his protege and his right hand man, his army man all the way through. They loved each other, absolutely respected each other, you know, to the max. But Dayan understood, as the buildup of this war was coming, that Israel could win on its own. Didn't need the Americans, didn't need the British, didn't need anybody else. But Ben-Gurion was from, say, a half generation older or a generation older, and he felt that Israel could not win the war by itself, that they needed the Americans to go in. And that was a fight that you couldn't, you know.
It's a fascinating backstory. Let's talk with Joe in Los Angeles. Joe, AM 870, The Answer. You're on with Stephen Pressfield. How are you, Joe?
Great. Mr. Pressfield, I really love your books. Two questions. The atomic bomb. There's some controversy about whether or not Israel had an active atomic bomb at the time, and whether or not because they felt vulnerable, maybe because they didn't have it. The second question is about the Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol. I may be mispronouncing it.
Yeah, Levi Eshkol.
Well, what do you think his impact was? Because a lot of people see him as being very heroic, you know, especially being as elderly at the time.
Great questions.
Yeah.
Stephen Pressfield?
I'm going to recuse myself on the atomic bomb thing. I just really don't know the answer to that. On the Levi Eshkol subject, I think Eshkol was, unfortunately for him, he wound up on the opposite side of Moshe Dayan's great charisma. And Eshkol, I think, was a very good administrator and did many things for the economy and for agriculture. But he was overmatched in this case because he was not a military man.
The eye patch deal.
Yeah.
No one.
You can't compete with the eye patch.
You can't compete with a pirate. And Yitzhak Rabin walking in with Dayan to the Western Wall. And I don't remember who the third one was.
Uzi Narkis.
Okay. That's an amazing. And the prime minister's not with him.
Right, which was Diane's doing there, because he wanted this moment to be a military moment. He wanted the world. He recognized the power of TV cameras and Life magazine, and this moment was going to, you know, be historic.
Screw with us. Yeah. We're the Israeli Defense Forces. Don't screw with us. In Glendale, Gary, you're on with Stephen Pressfield. Go ahead, Stephen. Have you bought the Lions Gate yet?
Not yet, but I'm going to.
Good.
Now I got a question for y'all. And, you know, studying military history, it was amazing that the Israelis just completely destroyed the Arab forces in 67. It was the most complete rout of an enemy since the German conquest of France. Did you feel the Israelis themselves were a little surprised on how, I hate to use the word easy, but it's the best word to come up with, but how they were able to overcome the Arabs with such great, overwhelming
finality. Stephen Pressfield, a minute. We got to go to the question. What do you think?
Answer really quickly. I asked the same question of Giora Rom, the fighter pilot who was the first Israeli ace. And he said that he likened the Six-Day War to a Hail Mary pass. And he thought that it was one of those, you know, once in a lifetime things when everything worked, even though it was, things were hanging in the balance in many, many areas.
But I wonder if it's dangerous that I have confidence that if they have to confront Iran, which is the existential question of the day, that I'm overconfident because of this. You think there's that danger now?
Yes, I do.
Interesting. We'll come back and finish the conversation
just
by talking
because
about that.
Nothing is sure. There's no such thing as a sure thing. I don't care how smart you are.
Absolutely well said. Stephen Pressfield is my guest. The Lions Gate is linked at HughHewitt.com. It's in bookstores everywhere. 3 minutes left. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. 55 minutes after the hour, America. I want to thank Marlon and Adam and Dwayne for producing a great show. My guest, Stephen Pressfield, for staying in studio with me. Our hearts and prayers for the 23,000 people of Southern California who have been evacuated. 5 wildfires burning in San Diego County alone. CNN's got some pretty great pictures, but remember, the pictures of fires, if they keep them away from the houses, that's what matters. 30 burned in Carlsbad. That's too bad. Stephen Pressfield, the Lions Gate is terrific. How did it change you?
Ah, that's a great question. It did change me, and I'm still sort of absorbing it and processing it. It made me much more patriotic towards Israel and much more identified with them. One thing, when you're over there, and I had never been there. I spent 9 weeks there this time.
How old are you? You've never been to Israel?
I'd never been to Israel, no. And I'm like the most secular possible Jew. You know?
Yeah.
I've never been bar mitzvahed. I don't know how to spell shalom, you know. But it really, the feeling over there, even though it's not pounded into you at all, is that if you're a Jew, you should be there, you know, and you should be defending, you know, the Holy Land. And they refer to, you know, where we live here in Southern California is the land of milk and honey, where life is easy. And life, it is hard over there, even today. I mean, it's not scary in the sense of, at least not to me, in the sense of, oh, you're getting it blown up. But it's hard. Like the way you check the news here, I'd be driving down with a friend of mine over there, Eli Rikovitz, and at the head of the hour, he turns on the radio just for 20 seconds, just to see, has a war started? And I asked him, you know, I said, why do you do that, Eli? And he said, you know, this is Israel. You have to know what's happening. So it's another world over there. And I'm become much more patriotic and feel much more bound to the people over there. But that makes sense because I got to know them.
And you know so many of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And as one of the people who called, you support them in a lot of different ways. Are they different from the IDF? Are the IDF different from other soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines?
Yes, they are. I mean, all armies are the same in that, in all those obvious senses. But like we said before, that concept of en brera, no alternative, just the geographic makeup of Israel, it's so small, the size of New Jersey, surrounded by enemies that want its extinction, want its elimination. So everybody over there is, women too, are ready. You have to be. And
wow. Wow. Well, congratulations. It's a terrific read. Again, America, the Lionsgate is linked at HughHewitt.com. Poor Marlon went down and tried to find a bookstore to get a copy out of. It's already sold out in a lot of places. I really do suggest you go to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or go get the ebook. But the ebook won't let you make notes in the margin. So I'm going to urge you. Sometimes novels can be read in ebook form. Go get the hard copy. And hopefully Stephen Pressfield will do a signing. Check his website. What's your website, Stephen?
Just my name, www.stephenpressfield.com.
And it's Stephen with a V. StephenPressfield.com, and find out when and if he's going to give a speech or a book signing. Thank you, Stephen. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest news, America. Stay tuned to this great station. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.